with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat Sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 22nd annual Arts and Crafts Show and Sale on Saturday, November 20th and 21st at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information is available at 367-9546.
Welcome back to hour number two, Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning, in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, we'll have our monthly program on personal finance, and our guest will be David Zinno, clinical professor of finance at the U of I. He's been doing the program with us for a long time, stopping by once a month, starting out talking a little bit about the economy or perhaps some kind of investing topic, and then we open it up to questions. And anything that's on your mind that has to do with investing and money management, I'm sure Dave will do his best to help you out. Then hour two, we'll be talking about an event that took place 25 years ago that still reverberates in American politics, and that is the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis. And our guest for the program will be David Harris. He's a journalist. He's formerly with the New York Times Magazine, and he is the author of a book that we'll discuss. It's titled The Crisis, The President, The Prophet, and the Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. That's tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Well, we have been here in our part of the state for a while now, have been enjoying some warmer than average temperatures, and that's really nice at this time of year. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, sooner or later, it is going to be winter. And indeed, we are now less than 2 weeks away from the first day of climatological winter, which, as we all know, is the 1st of December. Climatological winter is December, January, and February. And we want people to bear in mind that cold weather is coming, and cold weather can indeed be a problem. And in fact, here in Illinois and also in Indiana, officials have set aside this week as a time for people to think about getting ready for the cold weather to come, how to be prepared, particularly if you travel by car and there's any chance that you might find yourself stranded. You want to keep that in mind and maybe have a few basic things in your car to take care of that. Make sure your car is ready to go for the winter, certainly. And we'll be talking about that kind of stuff. Plus, in general terms, this morning we can talk a little bit about winter weather and winter storms and how they differ from the kind that we see in the spring and the summer. And our guest is our chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. And questions are welcome, all about the weather. Now, also, I want to make sure that people understand, on this program that we're doing here, this is not Talk to Ed. We can't take questions about places that you will be traveling. We'll do that tomorrow at the regular times, and then there'll also be some special editions of this in the run-up to the Thanksgiving, right before Thanksgiving, because we know a lot of people do travel at that time of year. So we can't do that here this morning. But this is an opportunity for you to indulge weather questions, the kinds of things that on the talk-tos, we don't have time to go into long explanations about the weather, but here we got plenty of time. So if you have questions about weather and about weather forecasting, now you can answer and ask him, and I know Ed will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's good to be here.
We certainly, each in the spring and in the fall, we always have these weeks that are set aside to talk about preparedness. And probably it seems like maybe in the springtime it has a little bit more urgency because severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, that kind of weather, it can hit really fast. And you want to make sure people have thought out in advance, you know, if there's a tornado warning, you should know what you're going to do, where you're going to go, that kind of stuff, because you might not have a lot of time to think about that. But, with winter storms, like we don't think about them being that dangerous, except they are. They can be very dangerous.
You think about them being dangerous when you're stuck in one.
Yeah,
exactly. That's when you figure that one out.
Exactly.
When your car breaks down or gets stuck in a snowdrift and you're in the middle of nowhere, that's when folks start to realize, yeah, this is pretty dangerous. You know, this is not a good situation. So that's why there's the Winter Storm Preparedness Week. about this time of year. As you noted, climatological winter starts in about 2 weeks. Also, the big holiday driving season starts tomorrow, really. We're Thanksgiving is a week from today, so a lot of folks hit the road. And, well, often there aren't big winter storms over Thanksgiving. Occasionally, we do see them. Back in 1950, there was a huge winter storm that moved across the Midwest and just buried a lot of the big cities, Chicago and Cleveland and Detroit. And the temperatures on the backside of that were quite chilly. We got down to 5 below 0 here in Champaign-Urbana around Thanksgiving of 1950. Which, interestingly, in 1950, our record high for the entire month of November also was established. On the 1st of November, 1950, it was 80 degrees. And by the time we got to Thanksgiving, it was 5 below zero.
So our record high and record low happened in the same month.
Or same year for the month of November.
Same year, yeah, okay. Well, yeah, right. This, the same year in November, we both had the warmest and the coldest.
So that gives you an illustration there that the weather can be very changeable at this time of year. So if you're going through a period where it's unusually warm, that doesn't mean it's going to last. And on the flip side, if it's very cold, back in 1991, we started the month of November with some low temperatures in the single digits and teens and thought, oh boy, here comes a really bad winter. And then it turned out to not. That was probably the most extreme as far as temperature we had that whole winter season, and that occurred in early November. Right. So every year is a little different, but if you're traveling, you really want to know what to do as far as some of the precautions. A lot of the winter weather precautions, though, are just using common sense. Although I know sometimes I have to be reminded of a few common sense items myself. So the first item would be to avoid all unnecessary travel. And if you do have to travel, and you got to really consider, do you really have to travel? Because some people say, oh, yeah, because I've seen more and more in recent years the attitude of, nothing's going to stop me. You know, and people getting irate at the airport, why isn't this plane taking off? Well, because they can't see the runway. Well, get it cleaned up. I've got to go right now. Well, because I've got to be somewhere. Well, sometimes you don't have to be somewhere as quickly as you think you do. But if you must travel in the winter, try to plan your trip in advance and certainly inform others your intended route of travel. Because if you do get stuck, at least then maybe they can send somebody out to find you. Mm-hmm. And allow plenty of extra travel time. And, of course, when you're going out in winter, wear warm clothing in several layers. And if you become stranded, you hopefully have the winter garb that you need, including a good hat, because a lot of the heat escapes from your head, as well as gloves, and you want as much of your exposed flesh covered as possible in winter, because you can freeze rather quickly. Your skin can freeze if it's exposed.
Yeah, so you want to make sure that if you have to be doing something outside, so maybe you get stuck, but you could do a little shoveling. You could put mm-hmm. out some, they say cat litter is a good thing to have if you're under some slippery conditions. Or if you're going to be doing anything outside the car, you better make sure that you're plenty warm enough and that you do indeed have gloves to wear and you got a hat so that if you got to be out there for some period of time, you're going to be okay.
And, of course, there's a lot of things you should be doing that we can talk about during the show regarding your car. I don't want to focus all on cars, but make sure your car is ready for winter. I heard Rick Karch on your program in the past week or so mm-hmm. mention that he thinks that if your battery, for example, is 5 years old or older, just get a new one. And that's probably something that you'll want to do because a lot of batteries die in the extreme cold. And that's the time you really don't want to get stuck or have to change the battery.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, if people have questions about weather, this is an opportunity to call in and ask. Talk with our meteorologist, Ed Geezer. We're particularly focusing on winter weather because this is Winter Storm Preparedness Week, both here in Winter Weather Preparedness Week, both here in Illinois and in Indiana. So 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk a little bit about winter storms. The big, I guess if people think about it, the big difference maybe between winter storms and those that we have in the spring and summer is that winter storms seem to move more slowly, and so we have more notice. In the spring, the Weather Service says, this afternoon, we're thinking that there's possibility of storms in a given area. In the wintertime, you may have several days' notice. You may look out to the west, because that's where the weather comes from, and we may say, 2-3 days from now, we think that we're going to have a storm. You know, why is it that in the spring it seems to go so fast and pop up with maybe not very much warning, but in the wintertime, days in advance, we may say, okay, we know that there's a big storm coming and it's likely going to affect us.
Well, storms on Earth occur in different time and space scales. Some are very large and last for several days or even weeks, and other storms are very small and last on the order of hours or even minutes. And the big difference is the scale that you're looking at. For a winter storm, you're looking at what we call the synoptic scale, the larger scale weather systems that move across the country that we track on weather maps. When you see the highs and lows and fronts, those are synoptic scale systems. And a big winter storm is a deep low pressure system, a strong low pressure system that will influence an area sometimes as large as around 1,000 miles in diameter, just a very big area. And, of course, it takes several days for one of those storms to move across the U.S., so we're able to track that over a longer period of time. And winter storms, by definition of that big low-pressure system, cover a large area. Interestingly, the severe weather we talk about in the spring is often associated with those large middle latitude cyclonic storms or low pressure centers. It's just in one quadrant of that whole big 1,000-mile diameter in which you're in what we call the warm sector or near the warm sector, and where you get the thunderstorms to develop, which are much smaller storms that last anywhere from a few minutes to a few hours in length. And the diameter of a thunderstorm is usually, say, 10 miles. Some lines of thunderstorms obviously extend over 100 miles, but they don't last as long. And, of course, then tornadoes that come out of some thunderstorms are on average only about a quarter mile wide, if that. So, and last on average only a few minutes. So you're looking at different scales of time and space. And the winter storm that produces the widespread snow and ice covers thousands of square miles, and as a result, we track it over several days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have someone here to talk with, a caller in Urbana. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
I have family in Traverse City, Michigan, and mm-hmm. that coastline of Michigan is a lake effect snow coastline that's sometimes pretty scary.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask is that how capricious are those storms? Would I be able to get regular, accurate predictions on that lake effect snow problem off of weatherchannel.com and various things like that, or do I have to be extra careful?
Well, I think when you go to a place such as the Weather Channel's website, it generally speaking, they have to broad brush things a little bit. So they may alert you to the fact that there will be lake effect in a general large area, which is a good thing to know about, especially if you're going to travel. But with a lot of lake effect snow, there's what we call banding, and there will be some areas where the snow comes down intensely, and a mile or two away, they're not getting much at all. And that then comes down to the details, which sometimes cannot be forecast very far in advance. And also, you have to then get more localized with the weather forecast as you are trying to get down to these smaller bands of snow. So if you're just thinking about, okay, I'm leaving Illinois to drive up to Traverse City, Michigan, is today a good day or bad day? The broad brush is probably good, because if there's lake effect snow forecast, it may not be snowing heavily, say, up the entire length of the Lake Michigan coast, but somewhere between here and there. Chances are very good that there's some heavy snow falling, causing some travel problems.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Hope that helps.
Thanks for the call.
And local National Weather Service office websites might help on some of that. In Michigan, the Grand Rapids office covers most of southwestern lower Michigan, and then I think as you get farther north up toward Traverse City, it would be the office out of Gaylord, Michigan, I believe, is where the northern Michigan office is.
Okay, because I know that I, for example, just went to the web page of the National Weather, or maybe I guess I started with the Central Illinois page. But what you can do is you can put into your browser National Weather Service, and then you'll get their web page, and then there's a map of the United States. And then if you click on the state that you're interested in, it will then link you to whatever the office is for that covers that area.
And for of course you can see their local radar too, and the snow bands that come off of Lake Michigan or any of the other Great Lakes show up very nicely on the radar. But I grew up in a lake effect snow area in Ohio, and it was just amazing to me how a little change in wind direction made a big difference, where one town could get over a foot of snow and the next town get none. It could even be sunny about a town away from where a foot of snow was falling. So lake effect is a smaller scale phenomenon, and as a result, it's very tricky to get precise with the forecast sometimes. Although lake effect snow forecasting is a lot better now than when I was growing up.
Okay. Well, again, other questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. When we get a really heavy snow storm, a lot of snow, a lot of wind, we might say that's a blizzard. Do meteorologists use that term? Does it have actually a technical meaning?
Oh, yeah. The blizzard's a real thing. It's not some made-up hokey term. In fact, there are blizzard watches and warnings issued by the National Weather Service. A blizzard, by definition, there's two components that are necessary. One, you need to have wind speed sustained for probably 3 hours or more of at least 35 miles per hour. So you're talking strong winds over a period of time. And to go along with that, you need to have either snow falling or snow being picked up from the ground that's blowing around, reducing the visibility often to a quarter of a mile or less. So that's what makes a blizzard. So you have strong winds with significant blowing snow so that the visibility is very low. And oftentimes, as a result, it's also quite cold out there, especially low wind chills. But you do not you can have a blizzard without snow falling if there's already snow sitting on the ground and the wind is just whipping it up.
So what now? Also in winter, like we do in spring, there are watches and warnings that are issued.
And advisories.
Oh, it's okay.
Yeah, it just is a nightmare sometimes as we make our own forecasts here at WILL, but we pass through official warnings, watches, and advisories, and there are 9 different National Weather Service offices that cover Illinois and Indiana, and they all seem to come out with different types of watches and warnings and advisories and different start and stop times, and to try to describe that on the radio is a nightmare. It's probably the least favorite part of my job in winter is just that, you know, just dealing with all of those. But basically, going from most urgent to least urgent, the warning, whatever type of warning it is the most urgent. There are blizzard warnings, heavy snow warnings, ice storm warnings, heavy sleet warnings. I've never seen that one, but that's a possibility. Or if you're going to have a combination of that weather, they'll just issue the generic winter storm warning. And usually that means you're going to get heavy snow and or ice accumulations that will cause a lot of problems, not only for travel, but it could relate to power outages and the like. An advisory is issued if it's going to be a significant nuisance but not up to the warning criteria. For example, usually if there's going to be somewhere in the 3 to 6 inch snowfall range, they'll issue a snow advisory. And if it's going to be 6 inches or more in 12 hours or 8 inches or more in 24 hours, they issue a heavy snow warning or a winter storm warning. So advisories are a little less a little less severe than a warning. And then the watch means conditions are looking favorable for a storm to come in within the next day or so that could cause warning conditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, again, we're almost at our midpoint here, and we're certainly up for questions about weather. Our guest is our meteorologist, Ed Keyser. And if you have questions about, and we're talking here about winter weather, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you another dumb guy question about sleet.
Yes.
Technically, when you use that term to a meteorologist, what does that mean? What is sleet?
Ice pellets.
Ice pellets.
So that's raindrops that have frozen on their way down. So it's just little frozen pellets, almost like hail. Some people confuse sleet with hail, actually. But hail is made way up high in a thunderstorm, several miles up in the cloud, where sleet forms closer to the ground. A raindrop falls through a significantly thick layer of below freezing air that the drop actually freezes up. So sleet is defined as ice pellets.
So that's and that's generally, you can feel that. You know that
you're
being hit by a solid, it can almost sting if it's really
stings, especially if it's windy and it blows in your face. And if it starts to accumulate, it's like walking on sand. It's kind of like walking on a beach. You trudge along.
Mm-hmm. And the difference between that and what happens in an ice storm is that they're actually, you're getting liquid, you're getting rain, but what happens is that if it falls on a surface where it's cold, or if the air temperature, it's coming down and it's warm enough at some point for it to be rain, but then it comes into another area where it's cold enough so that it then...
Yeah, it often happens. There's just a below freezing layer near the ground, and that could be a difference in wind direction. You could go up only a few hundred feet, and winds might be out of the south bringing in warm air, but near the ground you have a low-level northeast wind bringing in cold air. So if there's just a very shallow layer of cold air near the ground, raindrops will fall into that cold air, but they don't have enough time to freeze. So it's actually raining with the temperature below freezing. We call those drops supercooled. That's when it's liquid and the temperature's below freezing. But then when those drops hit anything below freezing, there's an instant freezing onto that object, creating a glaze. And that's the worst weather for driving. And, well, if you get a lot of it, it causes more problems than that. We remember 1990 and Valentine's Day and big ice storm that year. And usually about every decade or so, we get a big one in this part of the country.
Okay. Well, now we have some other callers here, and let's go to them. Number one, line number one, is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I had a question about tornadoes.
Sure.
Not necessarily winter-related, but you brought it up. I thought I would bring it up since I had a question. When I'd once seen the early formation of a tornado, the sky was greenish. Is that typical? And if so, why is there a green cast to the sky? Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah, it is typical. A lot of severe storms tend to have a greenish hue to them. But I can't give you a definitive answer on why. There are many that are trying to come up with that theory. The simple answer is a lot of people say it's refraction from hailstones. And I've heard people I respect say that, but they haven't studied that. People that I know that do study the effects of light on with different weather phenomena say, no, it's not because of hailstones. But then the question is, what causes a green hue? And there's not a definitive answer that I'm able to explain. There are some that have tried to explain it, and not in a clear enough fashion, really, that I understand it entirely. But that's one of those good questions. I even at a conference back in 1990, it goes back a few years, I was speaking, and I had a room full of meteorologists. I said, well, since I got a room full of meteorologists, I've got a question for you. And it was that question, what causes the green in severe thunderstorms? And nobody had an answer. But some will tell you it's hail, but others have disproved that theory. So
all right.
It's a good question.
Stay tuned. If we ever have an answer.
I'd love to know the true answer.
We'll get you. Let's see. Next is Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have this is sort of a humorous thing. I ride a trike in the morning for exercise because I could no longer ride a bike. I have MS, and also I've had a stroke. But I always wear a helmet. And my question is it safe to do that? I do this for exercise. I feel sort of smug because it doesn't take any gas and doesn't eat oats. So anyway, I'll hang up and listen to your answer, Ed, off the air. Thank you.
Is it safe to wear a helmet or ride a...
I wonder if she's thinking about the possibility of maybe... Well, first of all, on behalf of Dr. Robert Bocek and all the other doctors, I think they would say, if you're riding a bicycle, no matter what kind of bicycle it is, you should wear a helmet. This is good.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
This is good.
Based on what they say. So,
but maybe the second, I don't know, maybe it has to do with if there's snow or ice. Because, you know, I see, particularly around the campus, people riding bicycles when there is snow and ice. And I guess I wonder, gee, is that such a good idea? I guess that's, you know.
Well, first, I would think a trike would be safer than a bike because you have better stability, most definitely. I think some of that has to come down to thinking through a few things. One, is it practical to trudge through it? Because once snow gets thick enough, the pedaling is just going to be very difficult. But if you can handle that, there's no problem. The other thing you got to think about is, can others see you and can you avoid others hitting you if they are driving a car way too fast for conditions? So I'd say the safety issue is you got to consider the other drivers always and where you are. But just going out on a bicycle with a little snow, I don't think it's, or a tricycle even. Yeah. I'd say a trike's safer than a bike. And I do agree with her too. She said she feels smug not using gasoline. I wish that we could all do that, you know, because that definitely is a good thing too.
Yeah. So good thing all around. Wear your helmet. That's good. And particularly, I think it's a really good point that you need to make sure that anytime you need to make sure that you can be seen by other drivers, but particularly in the wintertime, you know, the visibility might not be good, or you might say maybe somebody's coming up to a stop sign, and even if they decided they wanted to stop, you know, it can be sort of difficult. So yeah, it might be, you know, maybe a little bit more challenging in the wintertime.
And once there's been enough snow that's plowed, that then it probably becomes impractical if there's just big drifts at every driveway and your big piles of snow at every driveway and the sidewalks are blocked and all of that.
But yeah, it amazes me though. I see a lot of people out riding bicycles in snowy and icy conditions, and I'd say, you know, you'd have to say, well, you know, good for, if you think you can do it, you're dressed warmly and, you know, you're careful, I guess that's okay. It can be pretty challenging. It can be like, you know, imagine riding a bicycle on a beach. On a sandy beach, you just getting the traction is kind of hard.
The traction's very tough, and then you start getting. My experience when I've tried it, and it's been many, many years. You just start to get some of that ice and slush caught between the wheel and the rest of the bike, and just it's very hard to pedal. That's been my experience. But
all right, let's talk with somebody in Saybrook in line 3. Hello. Is there a caller there in line number 3? We got you. Go ahead. Yeah.
My question lies in the fact that I think we have noticed their weather belts across Illinois. And in the wintertime, snows many times follow those belts, like either south or north of Champaign-Urbana. Is there any statistical evidence that the rain patterns of the summer follow those same weather belts of the winter?
Well, I think the one way I can answer this is this. As far as belts go, every storm will produce a swath of heaviest precipitation, generally with the bigger storms from southwest to northeast. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Every storm will do that. And then with winter storms, you'll, as you go from southeast to northwest, you'll get progressively colder. So you'll go from where the precipitation's predominantly rain to freezing rain, sleet, and then eventually snow. So every storm will produce swaths of, say there will be a swath of heavy snows, and many will have a little thin swath of freezing rain or ice. And it correlates to the precipitation pattern in the long in the long view, in that the farther south you go in, say, Illinois, the higher the average annual precipitation. The driest area of Illinois on average would be in northwest Illinois. The wettest area would be in far southern Illinois. So a lot of that has to do with the moisture source for storms being the Gulf of Mexico. So if you drew a map with average annual precipitation across Illinois, you would find tracks similar to, I guess, belts of how the storms travel, because there's just more rain to the south-southeast than to the north-northwest. But every storm is different. Every year it's different. For example, here in Champaign-Urbana, we usually get a mix just because we get enough warm air in most storms, but sometimes we get heavy snow, such as we did in 1999, right after New Year's Day. Sometimes we get the heavy ice here, which was the case on Valentine's Day 1990, and oftentimes it just rains, and then that's not newsworthy. Now, where you are in Saybrook, chance that sometimes when there's freezing rain here, you would get snow. Sometimes when there's rain here, you'd get a mix there just because you're a little bit farther north.
Thank you.
Okay. I hope that helps.
Very good. Let's go on to another caller, and this person is in Arcola, line 4. Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah.
My question is, I was born in the 70s, and it seems like looking back through pictures and stuff of some really strong winter storms that had moved through, and then it seemed like, I don't know, in the 80s or so, it just kind of petered out, and they haven't been nearly as intense. And I was just wondering, are there any indications or anything? Is that like a pattern to where they're not as strong nowadays as they used to be, or is it just the fact that I was a kid and everything looked bigger and worse?
No, I think there has been a pattern, some of it which can be explained and some of it that can't. But I can tell you the average annual snowfall has gradually declined a little bit here over the last couple of decades, and that's because in most years snowfall has come up short of the average. Usually, for climatological purposes, a 30-year average is used for temperature and precipitation, and every 10 years that's updated. And I would say I'd have to look at exactly how many years, but over the last two decades, probably somewhere in the order of 12 to 15 of those winters have been below average on snowfall. There have been a couple of winters close to average on snowfall and very few above average in the last couple decades. And we've been in a quiet trend. One theory which has not proven yet is, because there's a lot of things that influence the climate, but there's what's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which changes every few decades. And it's just a tendency from warmer than average to colder than average water over the whole Pacific Ocean. And it was in a phase, a positive phase, which would tend to give us milder winters if nothing else was influencing our weather. And we'll know in the next couple of decades whether that works, because it's supposedly going back into the negative phase, which would mean that more often than not over the next decade or two, we'd have colder, stormier winters. We'll see. The jury's out on that. Then there's the question about global warming, and that even with the global average temperature increasing, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden winter goes away. It may in some areas, and it may become more intense in others. So there might be some climate change going on, but we've had cycles in the past, too, where we've gone through many decade periods where most winters have been rather quiet, and decade periods where winters were incredible. David, I know you probably remember your early days at WILL. You had to work the early mornings, and didn't you, in the late 70s, huh?
Yeah.
And I'm sure you really enjoyed January of 1977, didn't you?
It was, yes, that was I do indeed remember that we had much – it was much colder and much – much snowier, and days when the wind chills were in the – it was minus 40, or – of course, we've changed the wind chill table, so maybe it wasn't quite that bad. But, yeah, we had some really serious winters back then in the late 70s.
Are there are there any indications that this year there'll be more snowfall, or do you not?
There's no good indication on that yet. I think it's going to be – a lot of times around here, we don't get many huge snowfalls anyhow. It's usually if it's a question of do you get one or two big storms a year or four or five that make the difference of whether you're below or above average on snowfall. And that just comes down to conditions that will form over the next few months. There's no real good indication of that. The Climate Prediction Center in Washington, D.C., does tilt the odds to slightly below average precipitation for this winter over our area and equal chances of above, near, and below average temperature.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I hope that helps a little.
It does seem that particularly over the last few years that we have had periods in January of pretty serious cold, which would make sense because that's the on average, that's when we get the coldest temperatures in January. But that for the rest of the winters, not too bad.
Yeah, not too bad. Usually there's a few other cold periods. As I mentioned at the top of the show in 1991, we had a couple of weeks of just unusually cold air in early November. Mm-hmm. And you can go back in there are a couple of years in the 80s where late December temperatures were dropping well below zero. But then there's other years we haven't even gotten below zero at all until sometime in January or February. So every year is a little different. And it's also interesting when I look back through the records, again, because one or two storms a year make up most of the snowfall, that often there's one month that tends to be the month. You never know going into winter which month it is, but some years January is the big snow month, and other years it's March. Occasionally it's December. When that happens, you think, oh boy, we're really in for it. And you may or may not be in for it for the rest of the winter. Every year is different in that regard.
Next caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I like to look at the radar displays, usually the one from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences for East Central.
I know what's coming, but go ahead.
Well, first of all, is there any good reference or sources for interpreting what I see on that?
I'd have to think about
it. Or should I just do a Google search?
It might be good to do a Google search. I could tell you that the radar is called the WSR-88D. It's the National Weather Service radar that they're showing. And that actually wasn't what I thought I was going to hear. I know the Atmospheric Sciences Department shows the raw image, which comes out of Lincoln, Illinois, remapped a little bit to more centered on Champaign-Urbana. And sometimes at night, you just get this big blob, and it looks like the end of the world on the radar. And that's in its fine, clear air mode, or even sometimes in the summertime with an inversion, the radar beam bends down toward the ground, and you're picking up a lot of what's called anomalous propagation. And I know we've had some complaints here. And first off, I'm glad you noted that even though we have links to it from our website, we don't control that part of the website. And what the Atmospheric Sciences Department is showing is the actual raw radar data. A lot of companies will clean up the data. They'll actually have computer algorithms or humans actually take out some of the anomalous propagation to make it look nicer. But I know that that's a complaint we sometimes get is there's this big blob.
It doesn't look quite the same as the one directly out of the ILX website. But you said earlier something about varying air currents, and what I've been noticing this morning is some strange-looking returns. Look like earlier there was a very small high rotating clockwise over us with some precipitation around the edge, and now it looks like that's dissipated, and there's a fairly fast-moving narrow band of precipitation heading towards us from the southwest, but right behind it, other precip is moving to the northeast. And so I was wondering if I could find some source to interpret these things.
Well, probably some of that, if you're putting it looping, it, some of it would just have to do with the wind at the level of the precipitation returns that's falling. And usually the precipitation moves with the cloud level of where the precipitation is falling out of. One thing to keep in mind, too, with all radars, individual radar sites, not the composites where they put it all together, the farther out from the radar site you go, the higher up into the cloud the radar beam is looking. So sometimes you'll be shooting up into a layer where winds are coming from another direction, and that might make it look like there's a change in direction of this, of the precipitation. So the farther out you go, it, the Earth, of course, curves, and the radar beam goes out rather straight.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let's keep on here. Next caller in line is over in Belgium. Line two. Hello.
Yeah, I am still scratching my head about setting fire to your ear, but that's another story.
Yeah, really. I'll tell you about that later. Ed's giving me this look like, what are you talking about? That was last hour.
Yeah. What I'd like to talk to you about is regularly you talk about El Nino and what effects it has or does not have in the Midwest. But here recently, in the most recent article of the Scientific American, they had a discussion about the Atlantic conveyor, which takes a lot of heat from the equatorial area of the Atlantic and deposits it in Greenland, and thereby affecting Northern Europe's weather, Northeast United States weather, and by that, affecting our weather. Because of the decrease in the ice levels in Greenland, the subductor could actually slow down because of fresher water causing the whole thing not to work because cold salt water drops. What have you heard about that?
Well, I've heard about the Atlantic conveyor and the North Atlantic oscillation, and there are a lot of things that are out there other than El Nino that can influence the weather patterns around the entire northern hemisphere. Of course, there's other parameters affecting the southern hemisphere, but usually you split the two hemispheres apart, and that's partly why long-range weather forecasting is rather difficult at best, because a lot of weather systems come and go more quickly than what's influenced by El Nino, and most of what happens in the Atlantic Ocean, from what I've read so far, happens seasonally and changes sometimes within season, so it's not as well predicted in advance. And then you brought up the other issue about the ice melting in Greenland and the differences between fresh and salt water, and I could tell you that that's not an area I've studied heavily, but that's something that climatologists are looking at closely, and those that are studying climate change. And I know the Atlantic Ocean is becoming an area that many scientists are starting to look at more, because it's not as well understood as the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Ocean is where you have your best long-term signals influencing the atmosphere, because it is the biggest water body. And but it's good to note that what happens in the Atlantic Ocean has an impact on weather systems moving around the northern hemisphere and is part of the puzzle that influences our weather, as well as El Nino in the Pacific.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you.
And El Nino, by the way, there is a weak El Nino, and I have mentioned in the past the only good direct correlation between El Nino and Midwestern weather is if there is a strong El Nino, there's a rather good correlation to above-average winter temperatures and about half the average snowfall in a given winter. Outside of that, it's just one of the players in our weather. But when El Nino is strong, which it's not anticipated to be this year, then that's a pretty good correlation. Outside of that, use caution. Anybody that says El Nino means this or El Nino means that in the Midwest, I would just take that with a lot of skepticism.
Okay, we have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, and we're talking about the weather, winter weather in particular. If you have questions, call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Urbana is the next caller, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I heard two focusms. One was red at night, sailor's delight, and when the wind is from the east, the weather's not fit for man or beast, or some phraseology. Is there any substance to that? And if so, can you tell me the mechanisms going on? Thank you.
Okay. usually there's all of the folklore. Well, I shouldn't say all of. Some of the folklore does have some basis to it from observations, but none of the folklore is 100% accurate. The red sky at night, sailor's delight, usually that means you're seeing the sunset in the west and weather systems move west to east. So that means the clouds are starting to move away from the west. So fair weather's coming in. And the other half to that one that I've heard in the past is red sky in the morning, sailor take warning. So that means the clouds are moving in from the west to the east, and you're getting that red with the scattering of light with the clouds out there and all. And then the red reflecting off the clouds, the red sun actually, the red and orange sun. The other one, wind from the east, but not fit for man or beast. Often when you get a strong east wind around here, that means there's low pressure to your south, because there's the counterclockwise flow around a low pressure system would bring in an east wind, and often that means the low is going to track by to your south and east, and you get on the side of the low with the heaviest precipitation. So when we get a strong east wind around here, it's usually a stormy situation that we're dealing with.
Okay, and Indiana, line four. Hello.
Yeah, I'm interested in line of sight, making everything equal. You're standing outside your house or where, maybe on a butte where the farmland is, and you see the clouds approaching from the west. Is there any good estimate just how far away those clouds are?
It's hard to say. I can tell you that out west, where there's less haze in the atmosphere, you can see clouds a couple hundred miles away if they're tall enough, because the line of sight, you can see pretty well over 100 miles. Even here, I could tell you, I can't remember, several weeks ago on a Saturday night, I was seeing clouds lit up with lightning from Champaign-Urbana, and those storms were southeast of Terre Haute, Indiana. Looking at the radar, could determine that. So oftentimes you can see clouds over 100 miles. The problem around here is you get into haze, and especially in the summertime, you can't sometimes see more than about 10, 15 miles. And to see a cloud 100 miles away is impossible when it's very hazy. So that's our biggest limiting factor. But with a clean atmosphere, you can see tall clouds. It depends on the height of the cloud, too. Obviously, the taller the cloud, a cumulonimbus cloud extending 10 miles into the atmosphere, you can see, I think, sometimes up to a couple hundred miles away if it's clear.
Okay. And we have someone here in DeWitt County. Line one. Hello.
Yes, I have a quick question. I found something from NOAA Weather out in my field after it harvested. And it's pretty well banged up, but there's a plastic envelope in there. Do they really want it back, NOAA Weather, out of Kansas City?
Yeah, I'm guessing what happened. You're in DeWitt County?
Yeah.
I'm guessing that is from, you never know which office, but that's from a weather balloon launch. And what you probably have there is an instrument pack from weather balloon launches to collect weather data twice a day from around the country. And balloons are, the nearest site is Lincoln, Illinois, about 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. is the official balloon launch time. They actually launch them about an hour before those times. So the data is being collected from up at jet stream level on a certain time. And what they do is they recycle the instrument packs. There's probably part of what you have there that has to get thrown out, but there might be some useful equipment inside there that they can reuse. And only about 10% of all of them are ever recovered. But every little bit helps, because the data they collect is very important, and it does cost money to collect that data, so they do want it.
I'll mail it back to them.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you. I know our John Frain from WILL-FM found one on his farm near Monticello several years ago, too. So they do land in central Illinois sometimes, mm-hmm. and they do have parachutes, so this thing should not come clunking down on your head at a high speed. It should be Nice, gentle drop.
No, right.
But what happens is the balloon that they ride up on gets bigger and bigger and bigger as it goes up because the air pressure on the balloon decreases, and eventually the balloon bursts, then the instrument pack comes back to ground.
Okay. Well, we're just about done. Any last thing you'd like to leave with folks before we finish up?
Well, we're going into the winter season. I can tell you that we'll keep you up to date on the weather here on WILL AM 580. And with our in-depth weather reports in the morning and midday, and now on All Things Considered, and your weather on WILL-TV at night on weeknights. And just use common sense if you're going to travel out of time. Get the car ready, winterized. Make sure the antifreeze is good, the tires are good, your light bulbs are all working, battery's good, all of that. And just make sure that you take what you need to stay safe, especially if you get stranded. Warm clothes, maybe some candy bars. There's one time when say it's good to eat candy bars.
Have some candy bars when you
things like that.
And if you're going to be traveling and you'd like to have a forecast for your destination tomorrow on Morning Edition, Afternoon Magazine, and then day before Thanksgiving,
2 days before an afternoon, we're gonna do the special talk to segments on the Afternoon Magazine next Tuesday, November 23rd at 12:40 p.m., and then next Wednesday, November 24th at 7:50 a.m. Central Time. So it's an hour later in the Eastern Time Zone, of course. And we'll be glad to take your questions then, and hopefully the weather will cooperate. I think it will for anybody traveling this weekend. It'll be well above freezing, and that's what I consider cooperating at this time of year. Next week, every map we look at is a little different, but it does show colder air coming in. So
all right.
If there's any concern, it'll happen then.
All right. Thank you very much. AM 580, WILL-TV, Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser. I appreciate you coming in and spending some time with us. The program today, Focus 580. In fact, all of our programs made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Focus 580 is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Tomorrow morning on our program at the 10 o'clock hour, our monthly show on personal finance, Dave Sinha will be here to take your questions. Also, hour two, we will talk with David Harris about a book that he's written that looks back to the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis. The book is titled The Crisis, The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon and 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And right now, we hope you'll stay tuned because up next is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, our monthly discussion about computers, computers and you. Peter Kimball will join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. That's 106 Central Time. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. December wheat, 317 and a quarter down.